There was a hole above his head, insulation and sheetrock hanging down in pieces. Emma? He almost choked on the girl's name, afraid to say the word to give himself hope. Emma Campano? He slammed his hand into the ceiling. It's the police, Emma! There was more scraping. The distinctive sound of rats. Emma! Will reached up, tearing chunks of sheetrock down from the low ceiling. His hands didn't work fast enough, so he used the flashlight to make the opening larger. Emma, it's the police! He dug his foot into the hole in the wall, propelling himself up into the attic. Will stopped, halfway in the attic, his foot firmly supported by the lath in the wall. Hot air enveloped him, so intense that his lungs hurt from breathing it. The girl lay in a heap up against the eaves. Her skin was covered in a fine, white powder from the sheetrock. Her eyes were open, her lips together. A large rat was inches from her hand, his retinas flashing like mirrors in the beam of the flashlight. Will pulled himself the rest of the way into the attic. Rats scrambled everywhere. One darted across the girl's arm. He saw scratch marks where the animals had dug into her skin. No, Will whispered, crawling on his hands and knees across the supports. Blood congealed on her abdomen and thighs. Welts strangled her neck. Will swung the flashlight at a greedy rat, his heart aching at the sight of the girl. How could he tell Paul that this was how he had found his daughter? There was no smell of decay, no flies burrowing into her flesh. How could any of them go on knowing that only a few hours had separated the girl from life and death? Will? Faith asked, though he could tell from her tone of voice that she knew what he had found. I'm sorry, Will told the girl. He couldn't stand her blank, lifeless stare. He had not believed once during the investigation that she was dead, even when evidence had stacked up to the contrary. He had insisted that there was no way she was gone, and now all he could think was that his hubris had made the truth that much more unbearable. Will reached over to close her eyes, pressing his fingers into the lids, gently lowering them. I'm sorry, he repeated, knowing that would never be enough. Emma's eyes popped back open. She blinked, focusing on Will. She was alive. Chapter 21 Faith stood in Emma Campano's hospital room, watching Abigail with her daughter. The room was dark, the only light coming from the machines that were hooked up to the girl. Fluids, antibiotics, various mixtures of chemicals designed to make her well again. Nothing could heal her spirit, though. No medical device could revive her soul. While Faith was pregnant, she had secretly decided that the baby in her womb was a little girl. Blonde hair and blue eyes, dimples in her cheeks. Faith would buy her matching pink outfits and braid ribbons into her hair while her daughter talked about school crushes and boy bands and secret wishes. Jeremy had pretty quickly shattered that dream. Her son's feelings ran toward uncomplicated matters involving football and action heroes. His musical tastes were deplorable and hardly worth talking about. His wishes were hardly secret. Toys, video games, and, to Faith's horror, the slutty little redhead who lived down the street. The past few days, Faith had let her mind go to that dark place every parent visits at one time or another. What would I do if the phone rang, the police knocked on the door, and some stranger told me that my child was dead? That was the terror that lurked in every mother's heart, that gruesome fear. It was like knocking on wood or making the sign of the cross. Letting the thought come into your mind served as a talisman against the thing actually happening. Watching Emma sleep, Faith realized there were worse things than getting that phone call. You could get your child back, but her identity, her essence, could be gone. The horrors Emma experienced were written on her body, the bruises, the scratches, the bite marks. Warren had taken his time with the girl, living out every sick fantasy that he could conjure. He had given her neither food nor water. Emma had been forced to defecate and urinate in the same room in which she slept. Her hands and feet had been tied. Repeatedly, She had been strangled to the point of passing out, then resuscitated. The girl had screamed so much that her voice was nothing more than a raw whisper. Faith couldn't help herself. Her pity didn't lie with the child, but with the mother. She thought about what Will had said earlier, how Evan Bernard had by all rights killed Mary Clark. There were two Emma Campanos now, the one before Warren and the one after. That little girl Abigail had nursed and played peekaboo with, the pretty child she had taken to school in the mornings and dropped off at movie theaters and malls on the weekends, was gone. All that was left was the shell of her girl, an empty vessel that would be filled with the thoughts of a stranger. Abigail was obviously thinking of these things. She could barely touch the girl, seemed to have to force herself to hold Emma's hand. Faith herself couldn't even meet the mother's eyes. How could you mourn the death of your child when she was still alive? Abigail spoke softly. "She's awake." Slowly, Faith walked over. They had tried to question the girl on the way to the hospital, firing questions at her one after the other. Emma had lain on the gurney, her eyes staring blankly at the ambulance ceiling, her answers coming out in monosyllabic bites. She had gotten progressively agitated until she was cowering against the rails, the impact of her ordeal slowly sinking in. She'd become so hysterical that they had sedated her so that she wouldn't hurt herself. Her reaction was strikingly similar to her mother's. "Hi, honey," Faith began. "Do you remember me?" The girl nodded. Her eyelids were heavy, though the medication had long worn off. The clock on the heart monitor read 6:33 a.m. Light peeked out around the edges of the metal blinds over the window. The sun had risen unnoticed as she slept. They had figured out quickly that it was the men who set her off. The male paramedics touching and prodding, even Will trying to hold her hand, had made her panic like a trapped animal. Emma couldn't stand the sight of any of them, couldn't tolerate the male doctors. Even her own father upset the girl so much that she became physically ill. Faith asked Emma, "You sure you want to do this?" She nodded. "I need to ask you some questions," Faith told her. "Do you think you can talk to me?" She nodded again, wincing at the pain when she moved. Abigail's fingertips touched her daughter's arm. "If it's too much, I want to," Emma insisted, her voice strained, like a person much older than her few years. "Tell me what you remember," Faith urged, knowing that the girl had probably been doing everything she could to forget. "It was Kayla," she said, her tone certain. "We heard her screaming. Adam went out in the hall, and I saw the man stab him." "Warren?" she nodded. Abigail reached for the glass of water beside the bed. "Drink something, honey." "No," she refused. "I need to say." Faith was surprised at her courage. But then she remembered that twice now Emma Campano had been written off for dead, and twice the girl had fought back. "Tell me what happened." "Adam told me to hide in the closet." She paused, some of her resolve breaking. "The next thing I remember, I was in the room, and the man was on top of me." Faith asked, "Did he say anything to you?" "He said that he loved me." She glanced quickly at her mother. "I told him that I did too. He was nicer when I did." "That was smart," Faith told her. "You did what you needed to do to keep him from getting angry."
"Are you sure?"
The girl squeezed her eyes shut. The heart monitor beeped. Cold air came out of the vent over the bed.
"You're sure he's dead?"
"Yes," Faith told her, putting all the certainty she could in her voice. "I saw him myself. He died last night." She kept her eyes tightly closed. "Are you sure that no one else came?" Faith asked. This had been the first question put to the girl, and she was just as unequivocal in her answer then as she was now.
"No."
Faith couldn't let it go. She had to be sure. "Warren didn't talk about anyone he was working with? No one came into the room with you?" Her eyes were still closed. Faith thought that she had fallen asleep, but the girl's head moved slowly from side to side.
"No one," she said. "I was completely alone."
Abigail reached out, but pulled back her hand, not knowing where she could touch her daughter, which spots would cause comfort or pain. She admitted as much, saying, "I don't know what to do." Faith took the woman's hand and wrapped it around her daughter's. "You already lost her once. It's up to you to make sure you don't lose her again." Faith could see Will and Amanda standing at the end of the hallway outside Emma's room. Both of them looked up at her expectantly. She shook her head, letting them know that Evan Bernard was still in the clear. Amanda took out her phone, and Will said something to stop her. Faith couldn't hear his voice, and frankly, she didn't care. She went back to the row of plastic chairs lining the hallway and sat down with a groan. Her exhaustion was so deep that she felt dizzy. Sleep was all she needed, just a few minutes, and then she could go with Will to scour Warren Greer's apartment again. They would turn the man's office upside down at the copyright, interview everyone who had ever known him or come into contact with him. Mary Clark had remembered Warren and Bernard together. There was bound to be someone else out there who knew even more than she did. Faith's head jerked up as she caught herself dozing. Her phone was ringing. She took it out of her pocket, checking the caller ID. It was Victor again. He was nothing if not persistent. "You going to get that?" Will asked. Faith looked up at him. He looked as tired as she felt. "He'll call back." She tucked the phone back into her pocket. "What was that about?" He slumped into the chair beside her, his long legs blocking the hallway. "The prosecutor says the judge won't deny bail." He rubbed his eyes. "Bernard's going to be out on the streets before noon." Did yelling at Amanda help? It's easier to blame her for all the evil things that happen in the world. He put his face in his hands, exhaustion slowing down every move. "What did I miss on this, Faith? How can we keep him locked up?" Faith thought about what was behind the door across the hall. Warren was dead, but there was still someone out there who should be punished for the crime. They had to make a case against Bernard. Will was right, he had to be punished. She asked, "What did Amanda say?" "She's moving on. Emma is back. We've got one dead prisoner and a lawsuit from the Alexanders to deal with. This case has basically been downgraded because we have a living victim." He shook his head. "What kind of job is this, where a dead 17-year-old is more important than a living one?"
"My boss hasn't taken me off this yet," Faith told him. "I'll work with you as long as they let me."
"Well, that's the other thing." Faith could hear the trepidation in his voice, and it shot a cold chill through her.
"Did Amanda find out about the gray powder?"
He looked at her, confused. "Oh," he said, understanding. "No. Worse than that. Amanda's going to ask you to be my partner." Faith was so tired that she was certain she had heard wrong.
"Your partner?"
"I understand if you don't want to do it."
"It's not that," she said, still not sure she'd heard correctly. "Your partner?" she repeated. "Amanda's been keeping me off every important event in this case," Faith said, thinking the missed press conference was just the icing on the cake. "Why would she want me on her team?"
Will had the grace to look guilty. "That was actually me keeping you out of the loop," he admitted. "But not on purpose, honest." She was too tired to manage anything but an exasperated, "Will, I'm sorry," he said, holding out his hands in an open shrug. "But listen, it's best you know what you'd be getting into."
"This is the last thing I expected," Faith admitted. She was still unable to wrap her head around the offer.
I told you about the crappy dental.
He held up his hand, showed her the scar from the nail gun. And keep in mind that Amanda doesn't take prisoners. Faith rubbed her face. She let the enormity of the situation sink in. I keep hearing those clicks in my ear from Warren dry-firing on you.
She paused, not trusting herself to speak.
He could have killed you.
She added, and I would have killed him.
Will tried for levity. You seem pretty cool to me. His voice went up in a falsetto as he mimicked,
Drop it, motherfucker!
She felt her cheeks redden. I guess my inner policewoman came out.
Pepper Anderson was a sergeant. You're a detective.
And you are pathetic for knowing that. He smiled, rubbing his jaw.
Yeah, you're probably right.
He waited a few seconds before saying, I mean it, Faith. I won't take it personally if you say no. She cut to the heart of the matter. I don't know if I can do this kind of job every day. At least with the murder squad, we know where to look.
Boyfriend, husband, lover, Will said, a familiar refrain. I'm not going to lie. It takes the life out of you.
She thought of Victor Martinez, his many phone calls. Jeremy was finally out of the house. She had met a man who might possibly be interested in her, despite the fact that she was painfully ill-prepared for an adult relationship. She'd finally managed to get some grudging respect around the homicide squad, even if their highest compliment so far was, You're not that stupid for a blonde. Did Faith want to invite more complications into her life? Shouldn't she just coast through on her detective's shield, then work private security like every other retired cop she knew?
Will glanced up and down the hallway. Did Paul just disappear? He asked, and she realized it was a question meant to put them back on more comfortable footing.
Faith was glad for the familiar ground. I haven't seen him.
Typical, he remarked.
Faith turned in her chair to look at Will. His nose was still bruised, a sliver of blue tracing beneath his right eye. Did you really grow up in foster care?
He didn't register the question. His face stayed blank.
I'm sorry.
She apologized, just as he answered, Yes.
Will leaned forward, his elbows on his knees. Faith waited for him to say something, but he seemed to be doing the same thing with her.
She blurted out, Moms, I'd like to fuck.
What?
That first day with Jeremy? You asked me what a MILF is. It stands for Moms, I'd like to fuck.
He narrowed his eyes, probably trying to put it into context. He must have remembered because he said, Ouch.
Yeah, Faith agreed.
Will clasped his hands together. He twisted around his watch and checked the time. Instead of making a comment, pulling some small talk out of the air, he simply stared at the floor. She saw that his shoes were scuffed, the hem of his pants caked with dirt from climbing under the fence to the North Avenue house.
What did Warren say to you? She asked. I know that he said something. I saw the way your face changed.
Will kept staring at the floor.
She thought he wasn't going to answer, but he did.
Colors. Faith didn't believe him any more now than she had before.
He told you the colors on the file folders?
It's a trick, he answered. Remember what Bernard said about how dyslexics are good at hiding their problem from other people? He looked back at her. The colors tell you what's inside the folders. With all that had happened in the last few hours, Faith had almost forgotten her earlier revelation about Will's inability to read. She thought about the psych evaluation Will had shoved in Warren's face, the way he had pressed his finger to each differently colored dot as he called out the findings. Will had never looked at the words. He had let the colors guide him.
What about the last sheet? She asked. Warren was functionally illiterate. He had some ability to read. Why couldn't he see that it was a dress code memo?
Will kept his eyes trained at the wall opposite. When you get upset, it's harder to see the words. They move around, they blur.
So Faith wasn't crazy after all. Will did have some sort of reading problem. She thought about the way he always patted his pockets, looking for his glasses when there was something to read. He hadn't noticed the rural route address on Adam Humphrey's license, or read the web page on Bernard's computer that talked about teacher retirement. Still, she had to admit, if you stacked him up against Leo Donnelly, or any other man in the homicide division, he came out the better cop. She asked, what other tricks would Warren use? A digital recorder? Voice recognition software? Spell check? Faith wondered if she could have been any more blind. She was supposed to be a detective, and she had missed all of the obvious signs right under her nose. Is that why Warren fixated on the colors? She asked. Did he see the different colors on your file folders and figure out you...
Colors.
Will interrupted.
He said, the colors.
A big, sloppy grin spread across his face.
That's what Warren was trying to tell me.
What? He stood up, excitement replacing exhaustion.
We need to go to the copy center.
Chapter 22. Will walked down through the cells, not looking at the crime scene tape covering the open doorway where Warren Greer had hanged himself. He could feel the cold stares of the prisoners follow him to the end of the hall. There were the usual sounds of jail, men talking trash, other men weeping. Evan Bernard was in one of the larger holding cells. Men who raped young girls were always targeted by other prisoners. The ones who were attached to sensational cases could pretty much kiss their lives goodbye. The transgendered cell was the only safe place for a man like Bernard. The women were usually arrested for crimes of circumstance, stealing food, public vagrancy. Most of them were too feminine to get construction work and too masculine to turn tricks. Like Evan Bernard, they would have been torn apart in the general population. The teacher had his hands hanging outside the bars, his elbows on the supports. The cell was a large one, at least 15 feet wide. Beds were stacked 3 high across the space. As he walked up, Will noticed that the women were all huddled around a single bunk, as if they, too, couldn't stand the sight of Evan Bernard. Will had a sheet folded up under his arm. The material was thick prison issue, bleached and starched to within an inch of its life. When he propped it up between the bars, it stayed that way. Bernard made a point of looking at the sheet.
Poor kid. The girls are crazy upset.
Will glanced into the cell. The girls looked ready to rip him apart. Bernard said,
I'm not talking to you without my lawyer present.
I don't want you to talk, Will said. I want you to listen. He shrugged.
Nothing else to pass the time.
Do you know how he did it? How he strangled himself?
I assumed he was the victim of some sort of police brutality.
Will smiled. Do you want to know or not? Bernard raised his eyebrow as if to say, go on. Will took down the sheet, unfolding it. He explained as he worked. It's hard to figure out, right? It doesn't make sense that you can asphyxiate yourself just sitting on the floor. He looped the sheet through his hand, wrapping the material around his arm. What you do is you tie one end around the doorknob, and then you loop it around your neck, like this. Will jerked the sheet tight, his skin pressing out between the folds. You kneel down with your head close to the knob, and then you start breathing really fast and really hard until you hyperventilate. Bernard smiled as if he finally understood. And then, just before you pass out, you kick your legs out from underneath yourself. Will pull the sheet away. And then you wait.
It wouldn't take long, Bernard said.
No, just a few minutes.
Is that why you came down here, Mr. Trent? To tell me this tragic tale?
I came down here to tell you that you were right about something.
You'll have to narrow that down for me. I've been right about so many things.
Will looped the sheet through the bars, letting the material hang down either side. You told me that dyslexics were good at developing tricks so that they can blend in with everybody else. True? True. It got me to thinking about Warren, because that day he went to Emma Campano's house, there were lots of things for him to remember. Will listed them out. What time Kayla was going to let him into the house. Where Emma's room was. How many pairs of gloves to bring. Where to transfer her from one car to the other. Bernard shook his head. This is fascinating, Mr. Trent, but what on earth does it have to do with me? Well, Will began, digging in his jacket pocket for his digital recorder. Since Warren couldn't write down lists, he made recordings. Bernard shook his head again. He wouldn't have recognized the recorder because it belonged to Will. Warren used his cell phone to make recordings, Will explained. He transferred them to compact discs that he kept filed along with customer artwork at the copy store. Bernard seemed less sure of himself. Blue, red, purple, green, Will repeated. That was the sequence he used for his discs. He clicked on the player. Evan Bernard's voice was easily distinguishable. No, Warren, the rope and tape will be in the trunk. Kayla will give you the keys. Warren mumbled. I know, I know. On the tape, Bernard was obviously agitated. No, you don't know. You need to listen to what I'm saying. If you do this right, none of us will get caught. A girl's voice they had verified was Kayla Alexander's, said, You want me to write it down for you, Warren? You want me to make a list? Will clicked off the recorder. You can hear the rest in court. I'm going free in an hour, Bernard said. My lawyer told me... Your lawyer doesn't know about the DVDs. Charlie Reed had been wrong about the cables in back of Bernard's home computer. They'd been attached to a recordable DVD drive. Will told the men, We have at least a dozen videos showing you in your special room, Evan. My partner is at Westfield Academy with Olivia McFadden right now. We made stills from the videos, pictures that show the girls' faces right alongside yours. So far, they've identified 6 students from the school. Will asked, How many more do you think we'll find? How many women do you think are going to come forward? I want my lawyer, now. Oh, he's coming. He seemed really eager to talk to you when I told him about the new charges. Will put his hand on the sheet, pushing it into the cell. Here you go, Evan. I don't want you to ever think that I didn't leave you enough rope to hang yourself with. Betty was on the couch when Will came home, which meant that Angie wasn't there. He took off his jacket and loosened his tie as he adjusted the thermostat. He had been in the house less than a minute, and he was already annoyed. Angie knew he liked to keep the air on for Betty. She tended to get nasty heat rashes in the summer. The answering machine was flashing. There was one message. Will pressed the button and heard Paul Campano's voice come out of the speaker. Hey, Will, he said. And that was enough. Will stopped the tape, not wanting to know what the rest of the message said. He didn't want to hear Paul humbled or grateful. The man had said his name instead of calling him trash. That was all that Will had ever wanted to hear. He scooped the dog off the couch and took her to the kitchen, where he was surprised to find her water bowl was filled. He examined Betty's bug-eyed face as if he could tell whether or not she had stopped drinking just by looking at her. He was fairly certain Angie hadn't bothered to fill up the bowl during the day. Betty licked Will's face, and he gave her a pet before putting her down on the floor. He scooped some kibble in her food bowl, then tossed her a piece of her favorite cheese before going into the bedroom. It was like an oven in the back of the house. He stripped out of his vest, shirt, and pants as he walked to the bed, tossing them all on a chair. Will wasn't sure what time it was, but he was so tired that it didn't make a difference. The fact that Angie never made the bed actually seemed like a good thing as he slid between the sheets. Unbidden, a long, heavy sigh came out of his chest as he closed his eyes. He put his hands on his chest, then he put them down at his sides. He rolled over, he kicked the sheets off, finally he ended up on his back again, staring up at the ceiling. The phone rang, piercing the solitude. Will debated whether or not to answer. He checked the clock. It was 10 a.m. There was no one in the world right now that he wanted to talk to. Amanda wasn't about to pat him on the back. The press wouldn't know how to get his phone number, and Angie was off doing her own thing. Whatever that was. He picked it up before the machine clicked on. "Hi," Faith said. "Are you busy?" "Just lying around in my underwear." There was no response. "Hello?"
"Yes," she said the word like a statement, and he realized that yet again he'd blurted out the wrong thing.
He was about to apologize when she said, "I told Amanda I'm taking the job." Several responses came to mind, but Will weighed them out, not trusting himself not to say something stupid.
"Good," he managed, more like a croak. "It's because we caught him."
"Bernard," she meant. "If we hadn't, I probably would have been fine going back to my little desk in the murder squad and biding my time until retirement."
"You've never struck me as the type of cop who works on a time clock."
"It was a really easy habit to fall into when I was partnered with Leo," she admitted. "Maybe it'll be different with you."
He laughed. "I can honestly say that I've never had a woman look at being stuck with me as a positive thing."
She laughed, too. "At least I can help you with your reports." Will felt his smile drop. They hadn't discussed Faith's obvious realization that there were second graders in her neighborhood who could read better than Will. He said,
"I don't need help, Faith. Really."
To cut some of the tension, he added, "But thank you." "All right," she agreed, but the strain was still there. He tried to think of something else to say, a joke, a bad pun about his illiteracy. Nothing came except the glaring reminder that there was a reason he didn't tell people about his problem. Will did not need help with anything. He could pull his own weight and had for years. He asked, "When do you start?"
"It's complicated," she said. "I've got a provisional certificate until I finish my degree, but basically I'll be in your office first thing a week from Monday."
"My office?" Will asked, getting a sinking sensation. He knew how Amanda worked. She had come down to his office a year ago and noted that if Will kept his knees up around his ears, another desk could easily be wedged into the space.
"That'll be great," he said, trying to keep things upbeat.
"I've been thinking a lot about Kayla." He could tell as much from her tone of voice.
"You mean the lawsuit?"
"No. Her motivation." Faith was silent again, but this time she seemed to be gathering her thoughts. "Nobody liked Kayla except Emma. Her parents were shitty. The whole school hated her.
From all reports, she was reviled for a reason.
But Bernard's such a manipulative bastard, it's hard to tell whether or not she was in it for the thrill or because he told her to do it."
Will didn't want to accept that it was possible for a 17-year-old girl to be so sadistic. The only thing he knew for certain was that with Warren dead and Bernard pointing his finger at everyone but himself, they would never really know the truth.
I doubt even Kayla knew the difference. Mary Clark still doesn't know. He considered the poor woman, the damage that had been done to her psyche. On the surface, Mary was living a good life, well-educated, married with children, teaching at an upscale school. And yet all of that meant nothing because of something tragic that had happened to her over a decade ago. It was the same way he had thought of Emma early on in this case. Everything she survived would make her want to die every day for the rest of her life. If the GBI and the Atlanta police and every other police force in America really cared about stopping crime, they would take all the money they poured into prisons and the courts and Homeland Security and spend every nickel on protecting children from the bastards who preyed on them. Will could pretty much guarantee the investment would pay off in saved lives.
"I should go," Faith told him. "I'm having lunch with Victor Martinez in 2 hours, and I'm still wearing the same clothes he saw me in last time."
"The guy from tech?"
"We'll see how long it takes for me to screw it up."
"I can give you some pointers."
"I think I manage that sort of thing well enough on my own."
She made noises about going, and he stopped her.
"Faith."
"Yes?"
Will struggled to make a grand statement, to welcome her into his life, to find a way to make it clear that he was going to do whatever it took to keep things running smoothly.
"I'll see you in a week."
"All right." Will hung up the phone, and a million better things to say came to mind, starting with telling her that he was glad she had made the decision, and ending with him begging her to forgive any and all future monkey business. He lay in bed, eyes on the ceiling, and ran through their phone conversation. Will realized that he knew exactly when she had decided to take the job. They were at the copy center, listening to Evan Bernard, Kayla Alexander, and Warren Greer planning the abduction of Emma Campano. Both of them were punched drunk with exhaustion, and their foolish grins must have alarmed Charlie Reed, though the man had held his tongue. She was right about one thing. As bad as the last few days had been, catching Evan Bernard made it all worthwhile. They had brought Emma Campano home. Warren Greer had meted out his own punishment. But there had been value in what he'd left behind. Kayla Alexander had gotten justice, too, no matter what her involvement had been in the crime. There was a certain satisfaction in those resolutions, a certain reassurance that what you did out on the streets actually mattered. Yet Will wondered if Faith knew that her father had an out-of-state bank account with over $20,000 in it. Will was 2 weeks into the Evelyn Mitchell case before he thought to check for accounts under her dead husband's name. The savings account was at least 20 years old, and the balance had fluctuated over the years, but never dropped below $5,000. The last withdrawal had been 3 years earlier, so it was hard to track where exactly the money had been spent. Evelyn Mitchell was a cop. She would know better than to keep receipts. As a matter of fact, if Will hadn't found the account, he would have assumed from the way she lived her life that she was clean. She had a small mortgage, modest savings, and a 6-year-old Mercedes she had bought used. It must have been expensive raising your child's child. Doctor appointments, field trips, school books. Jeremy wouldn't have had insurance. Will doubted 15-year-old Faith's policy covered childbirth. Maybe that's where the money had gone. Maybe she had figured there was nothing wrong with using drug dealers' money to take care of her family. There were tax issues, of course, but Will didn't work for the IRS. He worked for the GBI. And it was his job to present the evidence to the lawyers and let them decide what case they were going to bring. Will had been mildly surprised when he heard that Evelyn Mitchell was being forcibly retired instead of prosecuted. He had been on the job long enough to know that the higher up you were, the less likely you were to swing, but the bank account was the proverbial slam dunk. Now he knew why the woman had escaped with her pension. Amanda must have pulled some pretty long strings to keep her almost sister-in-law out of prison. The front door slammed. "Willie?" He was silent for just a moment, feeling the painful sting of his solitude being interrupted. "In here." Angie narrowed her eyes when she found him lying in bed. "You're not watching porn, are you?" Considering Evan Bernard's sex tapes, it would be many hours before he could think about porn again. "Where were you?"
"I went to see Leo Donnelly in the hospital."
"You hate him."
"He's a cop. Cops go to see cops when they're in the hospital."
Will would never understand that code, the secret language that came with wearing a uniform. Angie said,
"I heard you got your guy."
"Did you hear my prisoner killed himself while he was in my custody?"
"It wasn't your fault."
Automatic, the cop's Gesundheit of absolution. "He was one of us," Will told her, not wanting to say Warren Greer's name aloud to make him a living person again. "He was in and out of foster homes all his life. He finally left at 18. He was all alone." Angie's eyes softened for just a moment.
"Were you with him when he died?"
Will nodded. He had to believe that he had been there for Warren, even as the man took his last breath. She said,
"Then he wasn't alone, was he?"
Will rolled over on his side so that he could look at her. She was wearing shorts and a white blouse that was so thin it showed the black bra she was wearing underneath. Leo Donnelly must have loved that. He was probably telling half the squadron about it right now. Will said, I know you're not pregnant.
I know you know.
There was nothing much more that he could say on the topic. She asked,
Do you want a sandwich?
You let the mayonnaise go bad.
She gave a sly smile. I bought a new jar at the store.
Will felt himself smiling back. It was, he thought, the nicest thing she had done for him in a really long while. She started to leave, then stopped.
I'm glad you solved your case, Will. No one else would have gotten that girl back alive.
I'm not so sure about that, he admitted. You know a lot of this stuff is just chance.
Be sure to tell that to your asshole teacher.
Evan Bernard. Was the reading teacher's impending prosecution the product of chance? Or was that all down to Will's insight? Eventually, whoever was leading the investigation would have checked all of the CDs in Warren's office. Evan Bernard might have been in the wind by then, but they would have found the evidence.
She said, Maybe if you're good, we can buff the coffee table again.
Maybe the chair. My knees are hurting.
I'm not going to marry an old man.
He didn't say the obvious, which was that she wasn't going to marry anybody. Angie hadn't put her house on the market. She wore her engagement ring only when it suited her, and as long as Will had known her, the only commitment she had ever stuck to was one to never stick to commitments. The only promise she had ever kept was that she kept popping back up in his life, no matter how many times she told him she wasn't going to. She had bought him mayonnaise, though. There was some kind of love in the gesture. Angie leaned over the bed and gave him an uncharacteristic kiss on the forehead.
I'll let you know when your sandwich is ready.
Will fell onto his back and stared up at the ceiling. He tried to remember what it felt like to be alone. As far back as he could remember, there had never been that sense of complete isolation you got when there was no one else out there in the world who even knew your name. Angie had always been a phone call away. Even when she was seeing other men, she would drop everything to come to Will's side. Not that he had ever asked her to, but he knew that she would, just as he knew that he would do the same for her. Did having Angie in his life mean that Will would never be as alone as Warren Greer? He thought about the scene he had described to the younger man during the interrogation. The picture Will had painted of domestic bliss. Warren would come home to find Emma cooking dinner for him. They would share a bottle of wine and talk about their day. Emma would wash the dishes, Warren would dry. Describing the scenario had been so easy for Will, because he knew in his heart that Warren's dreams would closely parallel his own. Until recently, Will's house had looked like Warren's tiny room on Ashby Street. Everything neat, everything in its place. Now Angie's stuff was strewn about, the imprint of her daily existence firmly melding into Will's. Was that a bad thing? Was the inconvenience, the disruption, the price that human beings paid for companionship? Will had told Warren that guys like them didn't know how to be in normal relationships. Maybe Will had landed himself right in the middle of one without having the capacity to recognize the signs. Clicking announced Betty's entrance in the bedroom as her toenails struck the wood floor. It was as if the dog had been waiting for Angie to leave. She jumped onto the bed and looked at him expectantly. Will covered himself with a sheet, thinking it was mildly inappropriate to be undressed in front of the dog. Betty seemed to have her own issues. He saw what looked like potting soil on her snout. Will closed his eyes, listening to the creaks and groans of the old house, the compressor kicking in as the air conditioner whirred to life. Betty crawled onto his chest and took three turns before settling down. She had a little wheeze when she breathed. Maybe her hay fever was back. Will would have to take her to the doctor for some antihistamine tomorrow. He heard Angie cursing in the kitchen. There was the sound of a knife hitting the floor, probably covered in mayonnaise. He could picture her wiping it up with her foot, tracking it across the tile. Betty would probably find the spots and lick the greasy residue. Will wondered if dogs could get food poisoning, and decided the risk was too great. Carefully, he scooped Betty off his chest, then put on his pants, and went to help Angie in the kitchen. Epilogue. The Anthony Park house sat vacant. The furniture had been auctioned. The walls and floors had been stripped. Special cleaning crews had erased the blood, the scenes of crime. Yet everything was still exactly the same in Abigail Campano's head. Sometimes she would be in the kitchen of their new house or walking up the staircase and remember Adam Humphrey's face, the dark red of his eyes as she squeezed the life out of him. Despite, or maybe because of, the objection of their lawyers, Abby had written his parents a letter. She had told them what Emma had said about their boy, how he was kind and good and gentle. She had apologized. She had freely admitted her guilt. She offered them everything she had and was fully prepared to give it. Abigail had herself been a lawyer, and she knew full well what she was doing. 2 weeks later, a note had arrived in the mailbox among the various detritus strangers send strangers in times of catastrophe. There was no return address, but the postmark showed a rural town in Oregon. 2 short sentences were on the card inside. Thank you for your letter. We pray that we all find the strength to carry on. It seemed like such a trite statement, the sort of thing Jay Gatsby would say. Or the parting line at the end of an old black-and-white war movie. Carry on, old sport, carry on to freedom. 2 months later, life continued around them, but there was still the underlying threat of menace, as if they all expected it to be taken away from them. And how much they had to lose. The new house in Druid Hills was spectacular, even larger than the Ansley one. There were 8 bedrooms and 9 bathrooms. There was an office, a gym, a sauna, a wine cellar, a screening room, a keeping room, a mudroom. The carriage house offered 2 full baths and 2 more bedrooms. Walking around the apartment over the garage, Abigail had wryly commented that should tragedy ever befall their family again, at least she and Paul would have more space to get away from each other. He didn't laugh at her observation. She bought furniture, ordered bed linens, spent so much money online that the credit card companies called to make sure her identity had not been stolen. Everyone else seemed to be getting back to normal, or what Abigail thought of as the new normal. Beatrice was back in Italy. Hoyt had returned to his mistress. His wife was safely ensconced in the Puerto Rico house. Abigail was certain there was another mistress in there somewhere. Her father had been talking an awful lot about London lately. Even the press had finally moved on. People magazine and the television producers had dropped out early on when it was made clear that the Campano family had no desire to share their story with the world. There were the requisite self-proclaimed friends who came out of the woodwork to talk about Emma, and the ex-friends who talked about Abigail and Paul. Worse were the tabloids. They stood on the other side of the gate at the end of the driveway, screaming at anyone who left the house, "Hey, killer," they would say, spotting Abigail. "Killer, how does it feel to know you murdered someone?" Abigail would keep her face neutral, her back to the vultures as much as she could, then go into the house and collapse in tears. They called her cold one day, then praised her as a savage mother bear protecting her cubs the next. They asked her what she thought of Evan Bernard, the man who had brought all of this misery to their door. Every time Bernard opened his mouth, a news team was there, reporting live from the jail where he was being kept. If coverage started to die down, he made statements, gave surprise jailhouse interviews, and presented exclusive documents from his troubled past. Then the analysts would have their field day, expert after expert dissecting every nuance of Bernard's life, where he had gone wrong, how many kids he had helped during his career. Women came forward, so many young women. They all insisted that despite the tape, despite the video evidence, he was innocent. The Evan Bernard they knew was a kind man, a gentleman. Abigail itched to be alone with the bastard, to wrap her hands around his kind and gentle neck and watch the pathetic life drain from his beady black eyes. Listening to it all was maddening, and Abigail and Paul had gotten into the habit of turning off the news, skipping the talk shows because they couldn't contribute any more to Bernard's celebrity. They'd been doing this anyway whenever Emma walked into the room. The truth was that it had made Abigail feel dirty, as if she were reading her daughter's diary behind her back. Paul had even canceled his subscription to the morning paper. Dispatch had failed to get the notice. There were so many wet bags of newsprint clumped at the end of the driveway that the woman from the neighborhood association had left a letter in their mailbox. "I regret your misfortunes, but Druid Hills is an historical district, and as such, there are rules." "An historical district," Abigail had mimicked, thinking the woman had an historic stick up her ass. She had written a furious letter in response, full of condescension and vitriol. "Do you know what it's like to know an animal raped your child?" she had demanded. "Do you think I give a rat's ass about your fucking rules?" The screed had turned into a journal of sorts, page after page filled with all the horrible things that Abigail had kept choked in the back of her throat. She hadn't even bothered to read it before tearing it to shreds and burning it in the fireplace. "Bit warm for a fire," Paul had said.
"I'm cold," she had told him.
And that was that. It wasn't until recently that they could even go to the mailbox without having a reporter document their every step. Even the last desperate tabloids had moved on when, a few weeks ago, a pregnant woman in Arizona had gone missing and her husband had started to look awfully suspicious. Abigail had secretly watched the television down in the gym, studying pictures of the 26-year-old brunette, thinking jealously that Emma was much prettier than the mother-to-be. Then the woman had shown up dead in a vacant lot, and she had felt petty and small. With the reporters gone, they were all alone. There was nothing in their lives to complain about but each other, and that was patently forbidden. Emma had only left the house once a week since they had moved here. Paul literally brought the rest of the world to her doorstep. She was homeschooled. Her yoga instructor came to the house. The hairdresser paid a monthly visit. Occasionally, a girl would show up to do her nails. Kayla Alexander and Adam Humphrey had been Emma's only close friends, so there were no other teenagers knocking on her door. The only person Paul couldn't bribe to come see her was her therapist. The woman's office was less than a mile up the road, and Paul drove Emma there every Thursday, sitting outside the door, ready to rush in if she called for him. Father and daughter were closer than ever now, and Abigail was hard-pressed to think of reasons why he shouldn't give Emma everything she wanted. The irony was that she wanted so little now. She didn't ask for clothes or money or new gadgets. She just wanted her father by her side. Paul had started working 5 days a week rather than his usual six. He ate breakfast with them every morning and supper every evening. There were no business trips or late-night dinners. He had turned into the perfect husband and father. But at what cost? He wasn't the same anymore. Sometimes Abigail would find him alone in his office, or sitting in front of the muted television. The look on his face was painful to see. It was, she knew, the exact look she must have during unguarded moments. And then there was Emma. Often, Abigail would stand in the open doorway of her daughter's room just to watch her sleep. This was her angel of old. Her face was smooth, the worry lines on her forehead erased. Her mouth wasn't tense, her eyes not filled with darkness. Then there were times Abigail went into the room, and Emma was already awake. She would be sitting in the window seat, staring blankly out the window. She was there in the house, sitting not less than 10 feet from where Abigail stood. But it felt as if somehow time had fractured, and Emma was no longer in her room, but a million miles away. For years, Abigail had worried that her daughter would turn out exactly like her mother. Now she worried that she wouldn't turn out at all. How could this have happened to them? How could they survive? Paul wouldn't argue about it anymore. He got up and went to work. He drove Emma to her appointment. He made phone calls that kept their lives moving. They had sex more frequently, but it seemed utilitarian more than anything else. When she noticed there was a pattern, that Paul seemed to be interested in her exclusively on Wednesday and Saturday nights.